Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome back to the New Books Network. I am your host, Stephen Dozeman. The socialist activist E.T. Kingsley occupies an odd place in the history of labor and the left, often mentioned due to his prolific life of speaking, writing, traveling, and organizing. He has still generally remained wrapped in obscurity, leaving little in the way of a paper trail for us to understand who he actually was. Fortunately, Benjamin Isett and Ravi Malhotra have been working to correct this, following up their co-authored biography of him, which we covered previously. They have now put out an anthology of writings and speeches of Kingsley from the late 19th and early 20th century. While the entries tend to be short, their polemical nature and reflection on current events open up a window to the labor struggles of the Pacific Northwest a century ago, allowing us to see a new angle on and perhaps develop a new appreciation of our history. Ravi Malhotra is a professor in the Faculty of Law at the University of Ottawa. Benjamin Isett is a historian, author, and legal scholar in British Columbia. Ravi Malhotra, welcome back to the New Books Network.
Thank you so much for having me back.
Yeah, so I always like to have guests introduce themselves at the beginning of episodes. So could you maybe just tell listeners a quick word about who you are, what your work and research tends to focus on, and maybe say a thing or two about your co-editor today, Ben Isett, and maybe a bit about how you two met or first encountered each other.
All right. Try to unpack that. I'm Ravi Malhotra. I'm a professor who teaches labor law and human rights at the University of Ottawa. And Ben Isett's an independent scholar, city councillor for many years in Victoria, British Columbia. And also, he is, a lawyer that practices law now, so as well as a historian. So I bring to this project, and there were a total of three books on E.T. Kingsley in different ways. And Ben brings the historical aspect. So we started off with an anthology, Disabling Barriers, that collected work around disability history. Then we wrote the actual biography of E.T. Kingsley called Able to Lead, and you kindly featured me on a different episode. And then we wanted to collect speeches. And I give full credit to Ben. He came up with this idea. He wasn't able to be here today, but we collected the speeches and writings of Kingsley, and we collected them in a book that just came out from Athabasca University Press, but anyone can read it for free online on the Athabasca University Press website, and it's called Class Warrior, The Selected Works of E.T. Kingsley. And Ben made the point, it was literally a surprise to me, my idea originally was to have some of the writings, a small fragment, as an appendix to the biography. And then Ben said, no, we could have a separate book. So we did.
Yeah. So one thing you noted in our last conversation that I want to ask is what sort of paper trail did Kingsley leave? Because you noted in our last conversation that he didn't leave like as rich of a correspondence as many figures do. He didn't leave a lot of extensive personal writings. His main paper trail seems to have been kind of shorter polemical publications in various left journals. He wrote a couple somewhat lengthier pamphlets. Could you maybe kind of give us a sense of like, what did he leave behind in terms of writing that you're drawing on for this anthology? Like,
it's a very interesting question, because in terms of correspondence, there's almost none. I mean, to the extent that we could find it, there's very, very little correspondence. There's a little bit with one politician in British Columbia, and a lot of that is very utilitarian. It's sort of do this, go there. It's not very deep philosophically, even though we know Kingsley was a deep thinker. And so we had to trace content from newspaper accounts and from the editor, his editorial role as the editor of the Western Clarion, which was the organ of the organization he led in British Columbia. And of course, he was originally an American. And, you know, as I discussed in an earlier interview, you know, he crosses the border. He ran for both the House of Representatives and the Canadian House of Commons. He never wins, but he was also an activist in California. But in Class Warrior, we mostly overwhelmingly connect his Canadian period, simply because by the time he shows up in British Columbia, his nickname is the Old Man. He's a leader. He's not that old, frankly, but he's in his 40s. But he's at that point, a lot of his writings are available. There's relatively little from his American period, although he does give speeches. And he was invited by socialists in Nanaimo, British Columbia, on Vancouver Island, to come because of his reputation in the Pacific Northwest in California. He was well known as a soapbox speaker. And so he was involved in the Delayanist organization, Daniel DeLayan's socialist organization, which many Americans today don't know, but in the 1890s, before the era of Eugene Debs, DeLayan was the largest, he led the largest radical organization in the United States. And so, you know, Kingsley was very active, and he did have speeches there. In Class Warrior, we collect some of those, but it's primarily his Canadian articles and speeches. There's a couple that were reprinted in the Australian press. You know, and we were fascinated by the fact that somehow Australian radicals picked up on this. And so in his day, Kingsley, at the peak of his fame, was very well known. And so I'm very proud, along with Ben, to have a collection of his writings. You know, and I think that both his articles and his speeches give you a flavor, a window into the world, a world that no longer exists. It's a world of the early 20th century, and in some cases, you know, even earlier.
Yeah, let's pick up what you were just talking about, the world Kingsley inhabited. He was working, most of his political work was done first in California, then he kind of traveled up to the Pacific Northwest. One question that might be worth addressing is what socialism meant at the time to people working kind of under that umbrella, because it's meant so many different things to different people. When we say Kingsley was a socialist, or we could even say a Marxist activist or politician, you know, what would that kind of entail that might maybe kind of be different from what it is often meant today?
Such a good question. I mean, Kingsley has a story. It may be an apocryphal story. It's hard to verify these things. But the story is that when he had his accident as a brakeman, and I talked about this in the earlier interview, he becomes a double amputee, that he read Marx while convalescing in a Missoula, Montana railway hospital. There were so many injuries at the time. Railways operated hospitals. Is the story true? Well, quite honestly, you know, it seems far-fetched. Simply, if you look at the when translations of Marx were available, leaving aside how it got to Montana in 1890, which was, I think, just recently admitted as a state. It wasn't even a state, I think, until the 1880s. So it seems like there might have been a little bit of promotion on the part of Kingsley that the story is apocryphal rather than strictly accurate. But Kingsley had a very orthodox version of socialism, and we talk about it in this book, Class Warrior, but also, it comes out in the collection. Of course, Ben and I do have an intro that where we describe this, as does a foreword by the wonderful Canadian historian Brian Palmer, who generously contributed. But what I would say to answer your question, Stephen, is that it's an impossibilist version, which means reforms, sops to the system are impossible. And that's a very different version from, say, many people in the American Socialist Party that Debs led, that was much more about working within the system. And after the First World War, and Kingsley lives until 1929, that becomes social democracy. And it's a little bit ambiguous what Kingsley feels about the rapid changes in the First World War, the Great War, as it was known then, and the Russian Revolution. But it seems clear that he always maintained a radical position, even though he joined a formation at the end of the First World War in British Columbia, the Federated Labor Party, that went off after Kingsley's death in a more social democratic direction. Kingsley, as a very old man, runs for office in, for Parliament in Canada in 1926, one last time. And I think that if you read the book, you read the writings and read the speeches, you'll see that his vision of socialism is very orthodox, and that he's very much focused on class politics, to the point that, you know, there's positions that nobody in the modern world would defend today. So he's not particularly a supporter of women's suffrage. He sees that as a distraction from the class struggle. It's a very unblemished, uncompromising vision of socialism. And I think he imported a lot of what he learned from Delane. Even though he breaks with Delane, I think he imports a lot of that into his politics in British Columbia. So one of their slogans was no compromise, no political trading. That's one of the slogans of his party, of which he was a central leader. I think that gives you a sense of how he thinks.
Yeah, to tease this out a little bit, you mentioned impossibilism as opposed to like a more reformist approach to kind of class struggle and revolution. And one question I think you bring up in your introduction, or maybe Brian brought it up in his foreword, was the question of unions. So Kingsley would often speak somewhat critically of unions and kind of antagonistically, but you and Isa argue that a more nuanced kind of approach to both his words as well as his practice, you know, should push us away from thinking that this is maybe kind of an ultra leftist or more sectarian approach, and instead that, you know, this is maybe part of his kind of rhetorical style. He was often known to be somewhat kind of witty. He would use humor, sarcasm. You know, could you maybe speak to, you know, his style and how that might kind of, if you only read the writings without knowing about his background and his context, you might kind of get the wrong impression. Could you speak to that?
Oh, sure. So yeah, he had a very keen wit, you know, and I can't do justice to it. The readers will have to read the book to give you a full sense of the flavor. But I think what you said is accurate. I don't think the idea here is that we have someone who's extremely dogmatic. It's irrelevant. And yet we wrote three books that in various ways deal with it. I think it's more that the practice of the organization was actually nuanced. It was creative at times. I can give you a specific illustration, you know, this shows, I think, dynamism and flexibility. So like in the United States, when he was in California, both California and British Columbia had a lot of repression of free speech. A lot of Americans would find that surprising. Peaceful free speech, the First Amendment jurisprudence doesn't take off until many decades later. It's a different era. And so although a lot of historians associate that with anarchists, in fact, Kingsley led his organization in California, led one of the first free speech fights. And almost no historians that we could find, with very, very few exceptions, really talk about this in the 1890s. And this continues when he comes to British Columbia and he imports these ideas. So when to answer your question, the example of flexibility, sort of the nuance, is when they were repressing free speech in British Columbia, the municipal ordinance would prohibit political demonstrations on the streets, but it was biased. If you were promoting the ideas of Christianity or Jesus Christ through the Salvation Army, the government would allow religious figures street preaching, but they were suppressing socialists. So people in the Socialist Party of Canada said they would go into this body of water called English Bay off Vancouver, and they would sell their radical newspaper from the raft in the bay, because it's technically, it's not violating the municipal ordinance, the municipal bylaw, I should say. You know, so I thought that's an example that I think the rhetorical style is simply Kingsley's way of speaking. He used humor to get across his point, you know, and we start off our book in Able to Lead with an anecdote, you know, about a time when he's debating other people, and he tells a story of how the other speaker made fun of Kingsley's baldness. He's a bald man, and Kingsley says, well, you know, this other man says, I'm bald, and I'm paraphrasing here. He expresses it much more colorfully. He says, you can see my baldness every time I take off my hat. My opponent, his kind of baldness, you see every time he opens his mouth. So, you know, and so he had this very dramatic wit. He had this very polemical speaking style, and I think it was sort of, he felt that workers needed to be outraged, and, you know, he needed to raise consciousness, and that's why I think he spoke in this dramatic style. And it's true, though, the point you're making about humor, this is an era before television and radio, so a lot of it, I think, doesn't communicate the same way in print. There are actually a lot of the polemics were meant to be funny, to get the audience going. And you'll see the newspaper coverage is very different because newspapers were actually written in a very different way. There's a lot of verbatim coverage of meetings, and that's because there's no radio coverage, there's no TV coverage, so newspaper accounts were extremely detailed. And so you'll see in newspapers, and this is one of the ways we were able to prepare this book, is the fact that newspapers will actually reproduce political speeches at meetings in full. And that's something that just isn't done today. But in those days, it was.
Yeah, I think we can just pick that up as well. So you've got a whole section of speeches of Kingsley, but in many cases, you don't even have the speech. You have like some newspaper reporter's kind of summary of it, which is just a completely different way of kind of experiencing politics. You know, now everything is up on YouTube. It doesn't, you don't even need that expensive of a setup to kind of record yourself. But a lot of people were encountering Kingsley, you know, via kind of secondary information, summaries of his speeches and ideas. I'm wondering if you could maybe kind of speak a bit to how his ideas were being spread around and encountered by a lot of people. It was maybe a lot more kind of secondhand, word of mouth along the grapevine, that sort of thing. But in spite of that, you make it pretty clear that his ideas went pretty far. They went as far as Australia. He was invited all over to give speeches. You know, could you maybe speak to that dynamic a bit?
The how his ideas were disseminated so widely? Yeah, yeah. So I think part of it is that he was simply constantly active. And so people communicated in a way that was different from today. Obviously, email is instantaneous. Kingsley doesn't have email. You know, he communicates through correspondence. But despite being a double amputee, and in my earlier interview, you know, we talk all about his disablement, he also goes on cross-Canada trips, and both in California and in his Canadian period. And the last 27 years of his life, and he was active until maybe the last couple of years of his life, until he was a very old man, he is constantly giving speeches, you know, and he does do these cross-Canada tours. You know, and imagine, you know, today, 2023, going from Wisconsin to California. That's a long flight. People are exhausted. They have to connect flights. Imagine going by train in 1904 or 1907 across Canada. That's a big journey. But Kingsley did that, and he would report back. So I think the newspaper of the organization, the Western Clarion, played a role that was different today. Radical newspapers exist today, but they're not used in the same way. In those days, you know, people would read the papers, readers would write in letters to the editor, and they would dispute in the letters column, you know, this sort of thing. And newspapers would definitely feature speeches. And I think, you know, we did talk about this, but I think Ben and I, but I think it's reasonable to rely on these accounts simply because of the way journalism worked in this era. And so you've got, you know, very detailed information. And the fact of the matter is, despite the technological barriers, people were just adapted to it. So one of the things that, as a legal scholar, interests me the most, although, you know, I'm interested in all of it, had to do with the arrest of the American trade union leaders that were leaders of the IWW, I believe, the big Bill Haywood and some of his others. That became a Canadian issue. You know, despite all the distance, that was widely discussed when Big Bill Haywood was arrested. And to this day, some of your readers may have read the Pulitzer Prize-winning author who wrote Big Trouble. I think that's the name of the book. That's the 1,000-page discussion of this episode where Haywood is arrested. That was big news in the labor movement around the world. And, you know, you have Kingsley commenting on issues in Russia. You have Kingsley commenting on international issues. And so I think that people did communicate. They wrote letters. They traveled by train. And they kept constant touch.
Yeah. Picking up the remark you made about Haywood, you argue that in your introduction that this, among other things, Kingsley responded to with various writings, and that they're really important historically because you can see in these moments the nature of the state starting to change, and particularly in terms of security. So we talked a bit about this in our last conversation. The state started to kind of consider monitoring its own citizens for subversive activity as a crucial part of its own activities and responsibilities. That is kind of a change that's happening in the late 19th and early 20th century, and that often comes down in the hardest terms on like labor organizers and union organizers like Kingsley. Could you maybe speak to that and what some of reading some of Kingsley's writings helps us see, you know, in terms of that transition?
The transition of the security state. Yeah. So, you know, I think it's a very important point you make. In my mind, and perhaps Ben might have a different view, I bring the legal expertise, Ben's a historian, but I believe that it's really only after the outbreak of the Great War. And don't forget that unlike the United States, the Wilson administration, unlike the Wilson administration, Canada has no independent foreign policy at this time. London decides Canada's foreign policy. It's a dominion. Canada does not have an independent foreign policy until after Kingsley's death. So 1914, Canada's automatically at war. And so there's a lot of suspicion of radicals, although Kingsley himself was actually took an ambiguous position on the whole business of World War I, and he breaks with the Socialist Party of Canada after World War I. Nonetheless, from the state's point of view, they don't care about stuff like that. They see Kingsley as a dangerous radical. And that's not my opinion. That's what we found the intelligence documents that say this in the most colorful language possible. You know, they say that Kingsley is an out-and-out red Bolshevik and one of the most dangerous men in Canada. Those aren't things that I'm embellishing. Those are direct quotes from the intelligence documents. So I think it was in my mind, I think, sure, there was always some security, but I think in the hinterland, and this would be true not just in British Columbia, but also the American West Coast, and I think this is more confusing to Americans just because California's population has exploded. You have to think about how pre-earthquake San Francisco, which is where Kingsley lived in the 1890s, there was a different place. So I think there was always some security state, but it's really with the rise of the Great War, World War I, that you see this, and military intelligence starts looking at people who are opposed to the war. And despite Kingsley's own personal position, he's closely affiliated, and the majority are vehemently anti-war. This is not a position that endears them to the Canadian state, nor does it for anti-war radicals in the United States. And so you have, in both countries, suppression, particularly once Wilson decides to go to war. And so at the end of World War I, you've got repression of Reds in both countries, where, you know, and there's the mass labor radicalization, and the Socialist Party of Canada plays a role in that, in the famous Winnipeg General Strike, you know, which is a big, now it's not near British Columbia. But nonetheless, the intellectual ideas, I think, go there. And I would simply say that I think the state, increased over time. And, but this did not stop somebody from, like Kingsley, from continuing to write. And when events like the Winnipeg General Strike and the Russian Revolution happened, he kept writing. He didn't, as an independent person, no longer actively in the Socialist Party, but as a radical, he continues to write, continues to speak.
Yeah, along these lines as well, another important event you highlight in Kingsley's life and times is the Comagata Maru incident, one involving immigrant laborers, which again kind of reflects the changing nature of the state's capacity to monitor borders, bring in and transport or refuse people's entrance, depending on various things. I'm wondering if you, and Kingsley did write in response to this event, I'm wondering if you could tell us about his response, but also what we can kind of see in retrospect this event kind of embodied in terms of the changing nature of the state and capital and borders.
Oh, that's a really good question. So yeah, at page 200 of our book, we reproduce a speech by Kingsley on the treatment of Sikh passengers. Sikhism is a religion. They were passengers on this boat that was turned back because, these passengers, and some of them, from what I understand, some of them were Hindu, some of them were Sikh, but the Canadian media reports, they mingle all this. These kind of differences weren't well understood. And basically, it's an anti-immigration, minority sort of xenophobic reaction, shall we say. And it's interesting, I think, because Kingsley is always pegged as somebody that is marginalizing identities, that he's not sensitive to identities, right? That his Marxism is dogmatic, it's not nuanced. How much can we learn on this when we live in a world of intersectionality? But we're saying, well, wait a minute, if you go look at this, you'll see that, Kingsley completely sides, unlike others, that more moderate socialists that took a more bigoted position. And, in both countries, you see anti-Asian sentiment is very widespread. And, there's entire books written about anti-Asian labor movements in California. The same thing is true in British Columbia. There's campaigns, and I think they're successful in both countries, I believe. I'd have to go look at California, but I believe there's successful efforts to remove them from the franchise, denying Asian laborers the right to vote. I think that's pretty clear. And there's social exclusion. But Kingsley speaks up. Now, does he do a modern identity politics approach? No. But he defends them as workers and says, these people are together fighting the masters, sides completely with the workers on that. And so I think that in that, he really does take a principled position. And, it's something that, I think speaks to the fact, the force of his principled arguments.
Yeah, I'll pick up something you just said, that Kingsley is often accused of having a very reductive kind of class politics. And in the last century, we've had a lot of, extra views kind of brought in, questions of gender, race, sexuality, etc. And it's also kind of ironic, given that Kingsley was himself disabled. And then you could add, throughout the United States and Canada, there's the question of indigenous rights, from which British Columbia is not immune from that kind of questionable history. I'm wondering if you could kind of speak to, this very kind of focused vision of class, as opposed to kind of the more interdisciplinary approach that, a lot of leftists have tried to pick up. And you kind of wrestle with whether or not this counts as like a vulgar Marxism, or if there's maybe something we can learn from it. Could you speak to that?
Oh, so the intention of the books that we've written is not to argue against an intersectional approach. It's simply that Kingsley is fascinating in the approach that he takes, and that it's more nuanced in how he articulates. And honestly, we, as we talked in the earlier interview, we were interested in how his disablement affected his political activism. It's not intended to apologize for his vision. On some questions, you really cannot defend Kingsley, you know, on things like women's suffrage. And, you know, his vision is not something that's always sensitive. But what I would say is that the uncompromising nature in an era of globalization, and I don't want to be melodramatic, but, you know, many commentators often would say, I just recently finished reading all three volumes of Capital, the magnum opus of Karl Marx. And so some people would say, and I would concur with them, that if you take a look particularly at volume three of Capital, the trends of globalization that are discussed, or the spreading, Marx doesn't use the word globalization, but, you know, the concepts of Capital, the volume three of Capital is actually more salient in 2023. The book is weird, but it was weirder in the 1860s than it is today. It's difficult to read. It's complicated. And you can say the same thing about Kingsley, that is, his actually uncompromising vision is more relevant today, because in 2023, you have whatever term you want to use. You want to use it to proletariat, or you just want to say workers. The jargon doesn't matter. But corporate power is probably more concentrated, more solidified than it was at the time Kingsley was injured in 1890 than it is in 2023. So in that sense, I think that the relevance is there. That doesn't mean nobody here, Ben and I, are not advocating you take the ideas wholesale and apply them in modern conditions. But as someone, I think, that has a vision, in that sense, I think his views are more salient than ever, more relevant today than they were in the 1890s.
Yeah, I guess I'll ask, then, what do you think Kingsley has to offer in terms of, like, maybe kind of shifting our focus back towards class power and class struggle? You know, you're kind of arguing still for, like, a Marxism or a leftism that incorporates these various forms of identity. But then Kingsley maybe kind of can offer kind of a corrective to an overemphasis on those forms of identity at the expense of a class struggle politics. You know, do you see him kind of offering that kind of reminder of what can be done there?
Well, you know, as I think it's simply the example. It is my role and Ben's role is not to articulate a particular vision. What we wanted to do is bring the ideas forth, you know, and, you know, it's not necessarily to advocate personally, can't speak for Ben. You know, I think there's a place for reformism as well in making, you know, I think it's a strategic kind of decision in the modern world. The intent was not to present ideas that are directly applicable. I think it's more the example that this is a figure that presented. Readers will have to judge, you know, in the modern world, how exactly it would apply. Frankly, I don't think it's one thing or the other. In some cases, a focus on class politics is more so in one situation. In others, there may well be a place for campaigns of reform. But also, I would suggest that if you look at the practice of the organization Kingsley led, despite the rhetoric, I think that at the time, that that's actually what they did in practice. In building an organization, you know, you always have to deal with the real world. And there were examples of flexibility in order to sustain them. And there were continuous debates within the organization of people that wanted to engage more with unions, not just dismiss them as reformist sops. You know, Kingsley definitely was on the more orthodox side of it, but the people he worked with had a range of positions. And so I can't say that one or the other is best. It's going to depend on the context, I think.
Mm-hmm. So you're saying there's kind of a way we need to learn to, like, maintain flexibility in practice while maintaining principle, having a principled backbone that kind of holds us together well.
That's one way of looking at it. You know, I don't think that you can have a historical text that answers all your questions. Kingsley doesn't write about the ecological crisis because it's an issue that comes after his time, right? So he writes about the issues that were facing workers in his time. And the political period he's active in is from 1890 until, like, by the early 20s, he's really winding down. And so we never, you know, he says some things about Lenin and Trotsky, he praises them, but he doesn't, he never formally joins the official Communist Party, as unlike many of his younger comrades. And but he doesn't explicitly join social democratic formations either, despite a membership of the Federated Labor Party, formally joins, but all the evidence we see suggests he still retained radical positions up to the end of his life, it seems like. You know, and so there's but that's simply the fact that people, when they examine the work of somebody like Trotsky, for example, one of the things that happens is people die at the wrong time, right? And so what does Trotsky think about World War II? We don't know, because he's assassinated. And so, you know, the same sort of thing, what would Kingsley have thought of the Second World War and the Great Depression? We don't know, because by 1929, he's dead. And so as the debates in the Soviet Union pick up, Kingsley is not part of that, and we can only speculate. But he's really a man of an earlier time. And he's, in many ways, despite his writings coming from the 20th century, what I would argue is that because he was so old, in many ways, he's a man of the 19th century that lived on. His formative experience, his disablement, is in 1890. He cuts his political teeth in California in the 1890s. And so he's, to a large extent, I don't know to what extent he's constantly adapting. People often get fixed in their positions. So I think as he got older, he remained a man of the 19th century. But nonetheless, I think his writings and speeches provide important insights to understand labor history and lessons, broadly speaking, for today.
Yeah, you mentioned Lenin and Trotsky and the Bolshevik Revolution. So when that happened, that obviously sent shockwaves throughout the entire world, especially leftists and labor organizers. And Kingsley himself wrote a few pieces on that and spoke on it. Could you maybe speak to how the Bolshevik Revolution was received, not just by Kingsley, but by his peers? How was this event kind of being understood and assimilated into labor's understanding of what it could do, what was possible, what it might try and aim for?
Okay, so that's a lot to unpack. But, you know, we do have some extracts where Kingsley talks about this. And, one of the things you need to know about Kingsley is that before these events happen, one of his favorite speeches, and this is forgotten today, is the Commune of Paris. Now, historians that follow this will know this, but your general audience may not know that not just Kingsley, but for radicals of that era, the example of working class power that everyone talked about was the Paris Commune, or the Commune of Paris, the control in the 19th century. Some people even speculate that because German troops were used to suppress, or at least some people, being Ben and I think, you know, I think would agree with this, that there's some speculation on our part that Kingsley took his position on World War One because of his close reading of German troops suppressing the Commune of Paris, that he retained an anti-German bias throughout his life. That's speculative, and I don't know how much we've even written about that in Able to Lead, but that's the first thing you need to understand, that this was a comparison that was drawn. And the fragmentary writings we have that we've reproduced from Class Warrior are defending, Lenin and Trotsky. So we have a piece that he wrote, and talks about the suppression of the Bolsheviks the attempts by Western elites, at this time. How his colleagues, comrades, reacted depends. It's very different. So at that point, essentially, first of all, Kingsley had already left the organization about 3 to 4 years earlier. You know, he leaves, doesn't have much to do with the Socialist Party after 1914. But the party splits over this question, like in many countries in the world. So one group, I think a very large group, forms the Communist Party of Canada, which Kingsley never joins, and takes on a full defense of the Soviet Union. But that takes time. It takes a few years. And like in many countries, there's not that many members at the beginning. Well, and I'm not an expert and all the nuances. But, you know, it takes time, I think, to get going. Others took a more moderate approach. And one of the ambiguities is we don't have, and I think partly because of Kingsley's age, a concrete understanding of exactly the position he took. But the writings we do have suggest that it was a pro-working class defense. And I think that you have to bear in mind the reality of his age and disablement. So at this point, he's well into his 60s by the time we get up to the 1920s, right? And he, you know, in fact, I think he turned 70, right, in 1926. So, you know, he's also a double amputee. I think it's fair to say that he had a fair number of medical issues and barriers. It's not an unreasonable thing to say. So I think he simply becomes less politically engaged. But the core message, everything that we believe is that leads us to believe that he continued his class politics, which was support for the working class. But he didn't write a detailed book on this at that stage of his life.
Yeah, to backtrack a couple years, another thing that has come up is the First World War. And Kingsley spoke often on that, but he tried to, again, impart like a very aggressively class perspective, kind of talking about the conscription of the working classes for the sake of empire. Could you maybe speak a bit more to this particular view and how it was kind of, it functioned as a critique of the often kind of romanticized view of the war that a lot of young men were kind of inculcated into?
So you want me to speak to critiques of war? Is that the question?
Well, yeah, but I mean, more specifically, from what I've read on World War One, it was kind of viewed by a lot of young men who were conscripted in kind of these romantic nationalist terms. Whereas Kingsley had a much more grim and materialistic view of what war actually is in terms of, you know, how it uses and abuses the working class for the sake of, you know, just keeping the system going. Could you speak to that?
Oh, sure. So the thing about this is it's fascinating. What you're articulating is absolutely right in the broad sense. Kingsley does have this pro-worker view. He'll talk about wage slaves. He constantly berates workers for not having enough class consciousness. He berates them for not being radical enough. He has this approach. And again, is it humor? It's unclear. But, you know, some of it is very much condemning workers for not being radical enough, condemning their masters for their oppression and tyranny. But at the same time, as I said, Kingsley takes this position where he's actually so anti-German he leaves the Socialist Party of Canada that he's supportive of this, of the war. And so there is a piece that we found, I believe it's extracted here, but it's actually, in the end of the book, we extract some longer pieces that address the nature of the war. And despite this formal position, He does defend radical positions and wants the state to take responsibility for rehabilitation of the economy and rehabilitation of injured workers. But there's another factor, Stephen, that you have to take into account, which is it's a little unclear to us to what extent that Kingsley self-censored, because he has one piece, which interestingly enough, is monitored by the state, because I think it's commented on, that's entitled Win the War. Okay, that sounds very patriotic. The headline says Win the War, but when you read the piece, it's actually saying all kinds of radical things, heavily critical of the government's handling. So I think during the war, there was a little bit of self-censorship where he was saying things in a pseudo way to get around it, because the headline doesn't actually match the content. And but the censors... And one of the censors was named Colonel Chambers. The military censors were not fooled by this. They were closely monitoring people, including Kingsley, during the war. And I think they were aware that they would phrase things in certain ways, but they didn't brook dissent, you know, and they were, they were concerned about this. And without getting into too much of an aside, one of the big problems is that Kingsley wrote in English. And many radicals... at that time, many radical Marxists were publishing in Canada, and I think also in the US, in German. Certainly, it's well known that Delanus had one of the jokes about the Delanus organization is that one of the reasons they didn't grow is that they didn't have enough workers that could speak English to communicate with American native-born American workers. And nobody, they all spoke German. How are you going to actually recruit anybody? In Canada, you had a bunch of Finnish radicals. They're publishing radical socialist newspapers in Finnish, which is causing trouble in the Finnish community. But nobody reads Finnish, right? So, I mean, the security state was less concerned about that radical anti-war messages in German and Finnish because they could go and round up ethnic radicals. They knew where they were. It wasn't that dangerous. But somebody like Kingsley is giving speeches and writing in English. That's a big problem for the state. And so you can see why they continued to have a file on him. And they were concerned about this message that I think in substance, despite some ambiguities, was consistently critical. Despite whatever formalities they'd say about the war, it was critical and also critical of how returning soldiers were treated. Is that connected to the fact of his own disability? We don't have the evidence, but these are often men that came back as amputees. He himself was an amputee, you know, so you can see that. And from what I understand, the party was successful. Now, he had left at this point, but you had at meetings veterans that had been radicalized. And the government, and I think this is true in both countries, and this is also true, by the way, for your listeners, I think it's also true for modern wars, for those people that, listeners that are familiar with the Vietnam War, the governments of the day really, really dislike radicalized veterans because they see them as particularly threatening because those are people that are injured for their country. You cannot say they're unpatriotic because they're veterans and they're coming back and saying they're radical and not to believe the government, that the government's lying about what's happening on the front lines. That's a powerful message. So I think you've got, but in the last part of our book, Class Warrior, we do reproduce some documents around that, which I hope will be useful for your listeners.
Yeah. Yeah. So to kind of tie this conversation together, so one thing I appreciate about everything you've been saying and everything you say in the introduction is that often when engaging with Kingsley, you're kind of wrestling with certain things you're maybe ambivalent about or trying to kind of see what can be salvaged, what sort of limitations he might have because of his time and place. Beyond just completing our historical record, what do you hope people, particularly on the left, who come to your work and start to rediscover Kingsley in his world, are there any things you hope they maybe are able to learn or just forced to productively wrestle with in terms of like perspectives on class, race, you know, politics, capitalism, etc.? Like, What I like about your reanimation of Kingsley is that you're kind of more trying to get us to wrestle with the questions he wrestled with, not simply say he is the one who we actually need to bring back to solve everything. Could you speak to kind of how you hope people engage with this work?
I think it's the core message is that the uncompromising vision. And so I want to be clear. I mean, I think, you know, neither Ben nor I think I feel comfortable saying that, you know, endorse Kingsley's specific ideas as a course for action today. You know, those sorts of issues need to be discussed in the contemporary conjuncture with activists for today that will build on their own experiences. It's more the idea that he's so uncompromising at a general level, that he was so eloquent, and that it's a life lost. In the earlier book, we're interested in his disablement. He was a disabled man that, you know, was able to speak out. That is also interesting. It's less present in Class Warrior. And the fact that he was such a gifted writer, such a gifted orator. And some people are good at speaking, some are good at writing. Relatively few people are both great orators and great writers. And he was both, quite clearly. And so I think it is not the specific ideas as a guide for action. That's not really the purpose of the book, but it's more that he had these ideas, and these ideas in the course of labor history, I think, have been lost. He's a lost figure. And, you know, I don't want to exaggerate the importance in any way, but I think I said this in my earlier interview. Maybe it's a nice way to leave off. It's the lost nature is important to me, I think. The idea that you have a figure and you bring back their life, My friend who just died recently, Jeffrey B. Perry, wrote a 2-volume biography of Hubert Harrison. And when I first started this project, Hubert Harrison was an African-American thinker. He lived roughly around the same time as Kingsley. He was an African-American, came from the Caribbean. He was completely lost. In many ways, he's different from Kingsley, but he was also a radical. He was in the Socialist Party, completely lost from history. In some ways, and here I'm speaking for myself, I was inspired by Jeffrey Perry's books on Harrison, in that he brought someone back and he was able to show this. And so I hope, if anything, that readers are left with is sort of the fact that we're bringing to life a voice who had basically been erased. Remember, he'd been forgotten, he'd been lost to memory, and he'd been estranged from his family. So I don't think there was anyone to promote him later. So for all those reasons, Kingsley, I think, deserves to be remembered.
Yeah, that's a good note to end on. So as a final question, I always like to ask, guess what, if anything, are you working on now? Are you and Ben continuing to collaborate on anything, any more Kingsley work, or are you kind of moving on to new projects?
I'll answer that in two parts. So there is one last thing, one final thing we're working on, which is getting Kingsley's capsule biography in a book called The Dictionary of Canadian Biography. So in the arcane world of Canadian historians, getting a public figure into that is sort of an accomplishment, because then that person will be remembered. And I think it's a big deal in historical circles to get a historical figure into the Dictionary of Canadian Biography. It requires a certain level of geekiness to understand that. But, you know, in the historical world, that's important. In terms of my own work, right now I'm very slowly working on a book on the radical philosopher Cornelius Castoriadis and his work on, I'm applying his theories to the philosophy of time and applying that to the situation of workers with disabilities. And so I've got a government grant to interview workers with disabilities, and it looks at what disability scholars call crip time. And so I've got a book project and a book contract with Bloomsbury. And so someday soon, I hope to have the opportunity, when it's written, to promote another book. So, but that's what I'm working on, Stephen.
Yeah, that sounds really interesting and a great kind of jumping off point from what you've been doing. So we'll look forward to that. In the meantime, Ravi Malhotra, thank you so much for coming back.
Thank you for having me.